The committee will come to order. Members, take your seats. We have a quorum. Representative Haas, would you like to move the minutes?
I'd be happy to move the minutes. Chair from March 3rd.
Is there any discussion? If not, those of you who are in favor.
Aye.
No. These late nights are getting me. Representative Eakins saying the same thing. Well, at least we have three. The minutes are adopted. Let's see, who's here? Hanson, Representative Hanson, would you like to start?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Hanson.
Good to be here. Would you like someone to move 2573?
Representative Brown, do you want to move your bill?
I move 2570.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 2573 is a pesticide bill. Maybe just a little bit of background on my background, if folks do not know that. For almost 17 years, I worked at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture in the pesticide applicator licensing program. In that job, I did the commercial applicator, the private pesticide applicator, licensing. I think I worked with Mr. Representative Drazkowski when he was an extension educator. And we would work with training. And I often in the spring would take calls from folks who may have had, particularly in the urban areas, an application to the wrong site. The example would be, let's say I owned a house on Fifth Avenue and someone requested an application on Fifth Street. And during the hurry of the spring, the person on Fifth Avenue would come home and here are the signs in the yard and a commercial application record in their door, and they did not request it. And that we had difficulty in responding to that because we have very strong drift laws in Minnesota preventing pesticide drift. But this is not drift. It's not drift off of a site. It's an application to a wrong site. Now, occasionally this could occur in the agricultural areas as well, where maybe you have an application done to Roundup Ready corn that wasn't Roundup Ready. You know, but I think that in the rural areas, it's actually less of a problem because the commercial applicators in agriculture have the GPS and the computerized mapping of their site. So they know township range section. It's very computerized now, where you can track where you're going. In general, our laws in Minnesota, a pesticide includes an herbicide, an insecticide, a fungicide, a rodenticide. It's a very broad term. We do not break it down between metro and rural. We do not break it down between type of application. We refer to a pesticide as a pesticide. Where this came into my district is that last summer in the city of West St. Paul, one of our city councilor's neighbors had the Fifth Avenue, Fifth Street type of thing happen. They came home and there was an application that had been made, and it was not drift. And so the department could not take action there because it was not illegal to apply to the wrong site or the incorrect site. And the city of West St. Paul did pass an ordinance regulating pesticide applications, which I believe the department will probably be talking with them a little more about. My intent here, and I know that changing the pesticide law, folks are often very concerned about that. And it is not my intent that this bill serve as a vehicle for other bills. I believe that this is a very narrow problem that I'm trying to fix here, that if somebody applies to the wrong site, even if it may be an accident, I think that that's an important thing, that there's a regulatory consequence of it. And from my experience working in training, if you have a piece of statute that you can point to, you can train to that. You can say, you know, now this is clear. You've got to be real careful here when you're a commercial applicator, maybe in the lawn care business, you're making 20 applications a day. You got to really check where you're going. And if you're wondering what the enforcement mechanism is here in my bill, it would be going into the existing law. The department takes a step enforcement mechanism where there's usually an advisory letter, and I used to write these to people, an advisory letter, a notice of violation, and then after several of those, then there may be a financial penalty as administrative penalty. The department rarely goes to court. It's usually an administrative penalty. And I used to write those letters, and people would come into compliance. So that is my bill. I know that there are several stakeholders here. I did have an amendment, but the department has had some concerns with that amendment, so I have instead a couple oral amendments that I think will resolve the issue. And so if I could have someone move these, I will go through line 2.28. After the word apply, insert the two words for hire. And further on line 2.8, strike the word wrong and insert the word incorrect. On line 2.30, after the word manager, insert or property manager. That would be my amendment, and I can explain each of those corrections if someone would move it.
Representative Brown, do you want to move the oral amendment?
Yes, I would like to move the amendment.
Thank you.
The for hire has meaning in the pesticide law. For hire defines it as commercial applicators. So those people doing it for hire, that would exclude farmers. Really, a farmer is going to apply to their right site because they own the property or are renting that property. Incorrect, we feel, is a better word than wrong. Incorrect site. And then the or property manager, there are cases where there are utilities that are not the lawful manager, they are the property managers of the easement. So they are requesting the application for the easement. So that way this would clarify that they are the person responsible for the site. And there is the Department of Agriculture, a couple other testifiers that speak to these issues. So I can have the Department of Agriculture. Good morning.
Good morning. Would you...
I'm Paul Lemont. I work with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture within the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division.
Do you want to discuss the amendments or the bill? Or?
Well, in general, I certainly offer that Representative Hansen and his assistants contacted me early on in regard to this language. I agree with what Representative Hansen said, is that the language that we have in existing statute is perhaps vague and not clear to this sort of activity or illegal activity. And I think his amendment is clear and acceptable to us to be included as part of the prohibited act within the pesticide law.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think the amendment that Representative Hansen made from this desk a few minutes ago are also acceptable.
I'm going to get all those in favor of the amendment.
Oh, aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thanks. Representative Morrow?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if my question is better for Representative Hansen or for the Commissioner, but I just have a general question about the scope of what this would do. Maybe Representative Hansen, I'll direct the question to you if I might. What I'm reading here is this would apply to an application to 100 South First Street that should have gone to 200 South First Street. So I'm wondering about the applicator who applies to 10 yards of 100 South First Street. So in other words, goes over the boundary line onto another site. So when I read incorrect site, do you mean that to mean a wholesale application to the entire site?
Madam Chair, Representative Morrow, the site or what you're talking about is already illegal. If you have 301 and 303 Elm Street, and there's an application, and Mr. Lamont can correct me if I'm wrong here, but if you are if you're going over, and that's illegal under the DRIP in this application right now.
Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions or discussion? Representative Rostowski.
Representative Hansen, thank you. I'm trying to remember, we were dealing with, when I worked with Extension, we were working on pesticide container recycling, yeah. I think it was.
It was a long time.
Good to see you again, yeah. We both have more gray. A couple of questions. One is a concern. Certainly it seems that maybe this bill is looking to get to situations where intentional misapplications occur for sure. The part that I'm concerned about is when it's accidental, or when you look at how a lot of this happens. I don't know. You've certainly got more experience in this area, but I know how the communication between farmers and pesticide applicators works. Nail that field with this particular insecticide. Up on the far end of the the far end of the line fence, right off the road. And so there's certainly always, I would expect, not always, but a lot of these would probably be communication type issues, or the communication would probably be a significant portion of the misunderstanding, at least when it's not an intentional misapplication. And then there's a question about, is this the role of the department to be looking at what is a contractual arrangement between a business and an individual, and whether or not the communication happened correctly? I guess just maybe the response from both of you on that rambling for me. Sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Drzewski. I want to be clear that it's not an accident would still come in under this, or a mistake, because the receiver of the pesticide didn't request it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't request the application. Now, I believe that there's a teachable moment there where you can, and again with the steps enforcement process that the department uses, that you can have some protection there for the consumer who's not the customer, who did not order the application, and that the commercial applicator who's doing the application, they can be aware and trained and be accountable for that mistake, because mistakes will happen. We just don't want them to keep happening again and again and again. So it doesn't, if you have not requested the application and you get it, actually in the urban area there's probably not the economic consequence as there is in the agricultural area, where maybe it's not treated with the proper pesticide. Again, in the agricultural area, I believe that this is going to be rarer, because you have, if a farmer is contracting with someone, my experience with the commercial applicators in the ag area is that they've got this down in terms of the mapping and the applications and the history and the records. They have that fairly clear. And so the responsibility is on the commercial applicator. The bedrock statute, federally and statewide, is an application to the correct site according to the label. And so the commercial applicator needs to be aware of the site, the target site. They need to be sure that there's a target site. The label is the law, and it says it needs to be applied to that site.
Thank you. Representative
Hamilton? He answered a lot of the question, or what I was going to bring up as well. But what's the penalty on this? Representative Hamilton?
Madam Chair, Representative, the penalties for violation of the pesticide law are found in the Chapter 18B. 18B is the pesticide law itself. Penalties can range administratively from a warning notice to an order to cease and desist to civil penalties up to $7,500 per day, or in egregious situations there are criminal sanctions.
And Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, I think that if the follow-up question to the department is that their process is usually an advisory letter, notice of violation, and then the financial penalty after someone has received several advisories or notices of violation. And there's also usually a 2 or 3 year period that they'll look back in terms of that. So if you have multiple, usually the monetary comes in after multiple violations. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, it's a pleasure to be sitting next to someone so knowledgeable. But I would add that as an example of a wrong site or an incorrect site, we have unfortunately had occasions where an applicator has applied pesticide to a site that's inorganic. And that has significant economic consequence. And when we look at our penalties, we do take into account actual or potential damages to the party. So, I mean, in certain situations, a warning letter would be entirely appropriate. In other situations, we'd look at our sort of suite of penalty options.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hanson, thank you for answering these questions. I have a question about lines 1.13 and 1.14, and again, I apologize if you talked about these at the outset. I'm just wondering about the applicability of B with the change by adding sub H. Would section B then, or subsection B, still be needed? I'm looking at a person may not direct a pesticide onto property beyond the boundaries of the target site. A person may not apply a pesticide resulting in damage to adjacent property. Would B still be applicable even with the addition of H?
Madam Chair, Representative Morrow, B is relating to drift, and I want to be real clear that I'm not talking to drift. So you're keeping you keep B as existing statute. Mm-hmm. H would be completely separate,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to say that H is drift. We already have the drift requirement in B. Because H is targeting, it's not going to be likely adjacent. It's
right.
a different site. So, and if you're interested in the drift statute, then I'm sure Mr. Lamont would be happy to talk with you about that.
Madam Chair, I was just, Representative, just offered a comment. B, a person may not direct the pesticide onto properties beyond the boundaries of the target site. That is what I was referring to earlier, that it's vague if okay. you were okay. thinking about applying it to the incorrect site. But what that is important for is that we do have instances where an applicator is applying to a target site and simply does not turn off his equipment and move off target. It's not drift, it's an actual application, but it's not on target. And so this is a very valuable phrase to have in our law, and unfortunately we do have occasions when we need it to bring enforcement response.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hanson and Mr. Lamont, when there is a contractual agreement entered into and you've got 500 First Street and 500 First Avenue, and one party says that you said I was supposed to go to 500 First Avenue, and the other party said, no, I said 500 First Street, which one's right?
Elsewhere in the statute, we require that the applicator provide a copy of the record. So literally what happens is the one on 500 First Avenue comes home, and there's something in the door that says 500 First Street. You know, so they've made there's prima facie evidence that they made the wrong application, because they've actually left the record of that application on the site of the wrong application. In the lawn care business, what happens is you have a commercial applicator that goes out. They may, in the spring rush, they may have 20 sites to go. They have the record of where they're supposed to go, and they get the wrong map quest. That responsibility as a commercial applicator falls on that commercial applicator.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's really no intent or negligence needed. Pesticides are regulated under a strict liability sort of approach. So if for whatever reason the product was applied to the wrong site or applied wrong or drifted, there is responsibility that attaches. A simple mix-up may be taken into account as far as what sort of an appropriate enforcement response for that sort of mistake. But the violation is indeed apparent, if it is, as you described.
I have one other small amendment, that I believe will answer some of the concerns, and there may be other testifiers here. On line 2.31, after labeling, put a comma and insert or for public health purposes.
Senator Ethan, would you move the amendment?
I will move that amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And the purpose of that amendment, it is my intent that there are non-commercial applicators, which we have excluded, but there are some times when there may be a mosquito outbreak that is, or mosquito prevention that we want to try to, you may need to move quickly. You are treating an area. The area may be the city where there is infestation, and so the application is being done for public health purposes. This could be the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District or a city that is responding to an outbreak
that is a public health concern. So we want to make sure that, you know, you're not, if you're applying a mosquito control product, the prevention products are usually the briquettes that are dropped into the area. Sometimes when there could be a response of an application or response to an outbreak, there may need to be an application over a city area to control that outbreak. And I'd ask the department for that, for any comments.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, just this morning it was brought to my attention that there was concern about mosquito control operations not being selectively restricted, if you will. I guess if I may make a suggestion to the author, I think the words were "or for public health purposes," that perhaps that could be put at the very beginning, except for public health purposes, yeah. Comma.
I'm fine with that. The amendment.
Representative Eakin, okay. Will you amend the amendment?
I will move the corrected amendment, yes.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment was amended. And okay, now we'll vote on the amendment.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just one more question. Sorry to belabor it, but in the instance that Mr. Lamont, that you talked about, where there's organic production going on and pesticide gets applied to the wrong site, is there tort recourse for that landowner in that situation, the organic landowner?
Madam Chair, Representative, indeed there is. And in fact, we do not become directly involved in issues involving a tort or compensation. But oftentimes, our investigation files will be secured for the purpose of damage compensation and that sort. But pesticide law does not in and of itself become involved in third-party tort actions.
So if there is recourse, Madam Chair, if I could follow up, thanks. If there is recourse, in that situation, what is the reason that we need to make it a criminal act?
Madam Chair, Representative, it would not necessarily be a criminal act per se. We can bring criminal enforcement response if the county or the AG would like to prosecute it in such a manner. But it would be a violation of the pesticide law, and I can well imagine that a finding of a violation would be helpful to a property owner who believes he or she has been damaged.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think the people are okay in the audience, but they are not speaking to speak.
Well, we still have to vote to amend the amendment, so I'll put that on the amendment. Okay. Thanks for Kate. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. No. Any further discussions of the bill? If not, all those in favor?
Aye.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Bond, Executive Director of Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. I'll admit that I wasn't here for the amendments, and I just wanted to make a comment. We're not standing in opposition to this by any means, and I also want to compliment Representative Hansen for being sensitive and listening to concerns that have been brought here. Our members are those folks that are the commercial applicators in the agricultural community that spray and treat fields, and in addition also supply that those pesticides to farmers. And I asked a board member What is going to be your response to this bill? And I admit that in the context of other bills that you may well be aware of that have created a lot of controversy within the agricultural community, they were hearing, I think, my question through that filter. One of the things that he thought he might do then is require a farmer to stand at the field so they were sure that they were getting the right field. I'm not sure that that is representative, and I'm not sure that that would be ultimately how this works. There have been questions, why is this really necessary? On the other hand, Representative Hansen worked in the agency and enforced these laws, so we want to be respectful of that. I just want to add those comments because that's probably what our members would say if they were here this morning.
Thank you. Any more discussion? If not, all those in favor of the bill?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Bill passed.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I know there are a couple other pesticide ones, so if you need testimony, I could stick around for those.
Representative House, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 3361.
Explain your bill, Representative
House. Right. Thank you again, Madam Chair. And I think this is a good bill. It's an agency bill, but it is, I think, a very responsible government bill. It's reasonable what they're asking. I was in the farm chemical and fertilizer business for many years, and I don't think that what they're asking for the changes here are unreasonable at all. I think that they're good changes, and I'll turn it over to Paul Lehman from the Department of Ag.
Welcome.
Paul Lehman, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you for allowing me to speak to this. I'm distributing to members of the committee a pink, I guess it is, fact sheet on the ACRA program. ACRA is short for Ag Chemical Response and Reimbursement Account. It's an account that is available for reimbursement of costs of cleaning up either accidental emergency spills or for cleaning up contamination that has occurred over time. All funds within the ACRA account come from surcharges that we assess on ag products, applicator licenses, and so forth. This bill is simply, the objective of this is to make it easier and more clear for persons to apply for such reimbursement. We have instructions, and there are provisions in the law and in the rule which guide people to making such application for reimbursement. But this one area was a bit unclear. And between the council to the ACRA board members, and our department, the bill was written as you see presented to you. I shouldn't fail to mention that the ACRA board and its chair support this bill in the form you see in front of you. If you happen to answer any other questions or any questions.
Are there any questions? Discussion?
Just a couple. The dollars that are raised on the surcharge, is that enough money to cover the ACRA account or what the money is used for?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, indeed it is. I was going to check this morning what the balance in the account is. By statute, it's supposed to remain between $1 and $5 million. I wasn't able to get an up-to-date number, but I think it stands at about $2.7 million. And it is in the black. It is the ACRA board is meeting regularly, and reimbursing persons who make application for reimbursement.
Any other questions or discussion? If not, Representative Faust, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to renew my motion to pass House File 3361. And thank you very much.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Bill passed. Yep. Thank you. Representative Dunphy? Welcome, Representative.
Madam Chair, I move House File 3362, recommend it to pass, and be referred to the Committee on Finance. I want this to go to my committee. Madam Chair, members, this bill is basically says if you're a bad person in another state, you're a bad person here. So if you've had so a lot of you I know are going to fall under this. Who's from another state? Raise your hand. No. Colby. If you've had a license revocation or an action against you for applying pesticides in another state, it'll give our department the opportunity to take that in consideration in your licensing and or revocation activities in this state. That's it.
Do it.
Any.
Aye.
Aye.
And I'm trying to renew my motion that House File 3362 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. The bill passed.
Yeah, well, in Iowa. More like Iowa. Yeah.
Okay. Representative Dominguez. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
I move members. Adoption of the subcommittee division report on House File 3240. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? It has been reported out.
It's been adopted. The report.
The report has been adopted. I will move House File 3240 be recommended to pass, and I believe the bill is now in front of us.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity of coming forward in this committee, as we've done in the Veterans Committee. This is a bill authorizing a plaque on the grounds of the Veterans Affairs. It's honoring the Minnesota Mexican-American veterans, as well as the Minnesota veterans of all nationalities, ethnic backgrounds, and who have served in the United States Armed Forces during the time of the past and the present and the future. It is a plaque that we want to put up at the Veterans Honor Wall. And I have a veteran with me today, and also Paul from the Capitol Grounds, who has helped us put this together, along with the House Research. We put some language together that would was asked of us from the Veterans Division to pull together some language that would be sufficient enough to serve all veterans
But as you notice, it says Minnesota Mexican American veterans. They were the ones that first initiated this plaque, and that's most of the purpose why it's Mexican American veterans. These are veterans that have served in all wars, citizens of the United States of America. And if you'd like, we have some testimony here. You can hear it again, as we've done in the Veterans Division. Madam Chair, you were there, which I believe others were, some of the others were. And so we've come to this committee to get it passed through. If there's any questions or concerns, we certainly will be able to ask those questions.
Do you have an amendment?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't, we do have amendments.
Representative Eakin, would you move that?
Madam Chair, I move the amendment, the DE1 amendment.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's adopted. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Representative Dominguez and others, this is a good amendment, a good bill. I don't have a problem with it. You're paying for the plaque. That's good. I still don't have a question. I'm not sure how the plaque's going to read. Does it read Mexican-American and other, let's see, you put here, and Minnesota veterans of all other nationalities? Here's what I worry about. Mm-hmm. That next year, the folks wanted to say Honduran Americans, and the next year they wanted to say Guatemalan Americans. I have a lot of Mexican Americans in Wilmer, where the Latino population is very large. But it appears to me, and I'm no disrespect to Mexican Americans, but is there a way that we can avoid that by broadening? Shouldn't we be saying Latino Americans, or shouldn't we be saying something that's more encompassing? Because we have a lot of Latino nationalities in this state, and I get concerned that now we're singling out one, and as you know, the next year someone from my district is going to say, gee, can we get a plaque for, you know, my uncle or my grandpa who served and was not Mexican-American, but was another Latino nationality. So how are we going to avoid that?
I'd like to, Madam Chair, Representative Dunkey, that is a good question, and we have tackled that question, I do believe, along with Paul, and he can speak to this also. We put language in here that would serve, as you see, the language will read all nationalities and ethnic groups. So it is incumbent of us to include. We've been very inclusive, and we've been going over this with House Research, Paul and others that wanted to be very inclusive in this, and I know where you're coming from, because it was also mentioned, I must say that what about the other ethnic groups as far as Native Americans, African Americans, and so on and so forth. And so that's why we chose language that would be very inclusive. And Paul can speak a little bit about that, because we did some work on it.
And Madam Chair, while he's coming up to the mic, I don't know that that addresses my concern, because it still says Mexican Americans, and you say all other nationalities. Why would you even single out the one, I guess, is my question.
I heard a lot of the testimony, too,
yeah.
But I think the fact that they are the ones that came forward, they're the ones that put forward the money on, and then... And I think that was something that we kind of worked out in that first committee.
Yes, Madam Chair, you hit it right there, and you're correct, and I failed to mention that. Again, as my opening statement, I mentioned that the reason why the Mexican Americans were picked out is because they came forward with this bill to recognize, and they are paying for the plaque. They're not asking any of the other nationalities or ethnic groups to pay for it. They're coming forward with their own money, and so we thought with that initiative, that's why we focused on the Mexican-American vets.
Madam Chair, maybe I can ask this another way. How much room is there at the Court of Honor? Because when you come forward, that's fine. Do we have room then when the Native Americans, when the Guatemalans, when the Hondurans, when the whatever Americans come forward? Are there enough room for the plaques? I'm not arguing that you're paying for it and everything else and that it should say Mexican. I'm just saying, do we have room then when all the other nationalities come forward and say, we'd like to pay for it, can we place a plaque there now? If there's room, I'm fine with that. I'm just asking some logistical questions here. Based on the Capitol grounds, and I haven't been out to the Court of Honor for a while, I'm trying to picture it in my mind how many plaques we can put out there. And so if other groups come and say, we want to pay for it, and we want to put our name out there, Native American veterans, others, is there enough room to do that? That would be my question.
Madam Chair, Paul Mandel, I'm Principal Planner for the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. The question that you ask is one that is always troubling to us. There are, as you see from the House Research summary, there are currently 13 plaques in place, two pending, that have already been approved and put into law. There are only 9 spots left. And as I testified to the committee the other day on the veterans group, we have not yet had requests for a plaque for Desert Storm or for the current wars in Afghanistan or Iraq. This is a constant concern of ours, and it likewise is a concern when people come forward with memorials. We try to run interference if people come to us before they come to the legislature and requests such as a memorial to Bob Hope, who clearly did a lot of good but maybe never even set foot in Minnesota. The language that we have suggested in working this compromise out, I believe, does the best job possible, as long as we're naming Mexican Americans by name, of including everyone else and hoping that that serves a purpose. We as you can see from the it's a troubling question, so it's hard to answer emphatically, because the test will be whether you get a request next year and the year after, and we obviously can't preclude that. As I testified the other day, we had a request originally from the Merchant Marine and another group that were civilians, and usually the Court of Honor is reserved for members of the armed forces. So we actually did a plaque, but because we in the Veterans Servicemen folks have to approve the language, we worked out a deal where we included, it ended up being 38 organizations that were included in one plaque. That included the Merchant Marine, that included the WAVES and the WACS, and, in fact, 3 or 4 organizations of Northwest Airlines people that actually flew planes into the war zone. I guess that the test will be in time and what comes forward to the legislation, but I worked with this, after working with the representative on this language the other day in the committee, I talked with our multicultural representative at my school district, and I'm on the school board in Inver Grove Heights, and she said, that should be all-inclusive. Now, that doesn't mean people won't take offense and say it like you said. I'll pay for one if I can get my group's name in there. Our argument would be that this language now is all-inclusive, and hope that that stands up. But in Washington, D.C., just for the Vietnam Memorial alone, there are 28 pending applications for groups to be included. First there was the wall, then there were the nurses, then there were the soldiers, and there's the K-9 Corps, and Native Americans, and the African Americans, and there's 28 other groups that are still pending before Congress and the proper authorities. So it is an ongoing issue, but there are only 9 spots left right now on the current existing wall.
Madam Chair.
Representative Junkie.
Again, I would suggest that the Capitol folks that just testified maybe run the language by at least our councils of color. They all have executive directors, and at least get their okay on it, because you know they're here to advise us too. Chicano Latino Affairs and African American and the
Well, there's four of them, I think. I can't even say them. I'm on the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, so I'm sensitive to that. But if you would at least, I would think you should ask them, does this cover it? Because they'll certainly be weighing in, too, in the future if something comes up. That would be helpful. And they're there to advise you and us on these issues.
Representative Duskowski.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Dominguez and others, thank you for bringing this forward. Let me get this thing to work here. This seems to be identifying minority groups who contributed to our wars. I'm just thinking of a solution. Could you design the plaque in a way that if other groups came forward later, they could be added onto your particular plaque? Have you considered that?
Madam Chair, the plaques are cast in bronze. They run about $5,000, so to make any additions, you would have to replace the plaque. And it's not like granite where we can add names that we do all the time on the Korean Memorial and the Vietnam Memorial. So it would be a complete recasting. And I'm sorry, as I testified the other day, if we started to list, I mean, you folks run for office all the time, and probably your first precept is when you start thanking people, you never do a list because you will always leave someone off.
You know, and I just want to say again, within the Veterans Committee, we worked really hard to find the languages, and I just want to say again, it was the Mexican American veterans who did come forward, raised the money. And in looking at the plaque at a different time, when they were forthright first, and have really really looked at this and were okay with them saying that they were the ones that, you know, spent the money and so we have to look a little bit about the veterans that were sitting around the table in Representative Coonan's committee. Any other discussion? Representative Brown.
Madam Chair, my question is, and maybe I just don't understand the way this is written, will the plaque actually be worded in the way that this is presented here, or is it going to be worded as a list? When I look at other groups and that sort of thing, is that how it's actually going to be worded?
That's how it's going to be worded.
Okay.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dominguez. Representative Dominguez, I certainly support the effort to recognize the contributions of all races. We've got one gender designation on the current plaque with the women veterans. At the same time, I have to express a little concern with the plaque as it's worded right now, and I'm following with Representative Junkie. I think I can foresee in my own district other groups that are going to come forward, and they're going to raise one of two concerns. If they have the money, then I have no reason to vote no on a plaque that says blank American. And I do foresee African American as being one of those that I think would be a natural follow-up. And I would imagine you'd support that if they have the money as well. Which raises my second question. While I laud and I praise and I appreciate that this group has raised the money for the plaque, I don't want also to say you get a plaque if you raise the money for your plaque, but if you don't raise the money for your plaque, then you're not going to be recognized. And I'm worried about that implication to groups that may not have the financial resources to raise the money. I don't know the amount of money for the plaque, but I don't know that this should be an area in which we allow people to be explicitly recognized. And then my third point, I suppose, is following Representative Brown, if we want to recognize the efforts of people of color to all of the our efforts in military affair conflict, I'd be much more comfortable with that because that, to me, would be a truly all-inclusive. But I understand that the fundraising now gets back to that question of who should be named on the plaque. So I express those concerns. I don't want to leave you wondering where I stand on that.
Do you want to respond, sir? Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Morrow. But I think if you read into the plaque language, you will find that we are not leaving out anyone with the ethnic background language, the nationality languages. We're inclusive, and that's the language that we have been working on with the Veterans Division as they suggested. So we're not leaving out any ethnic group. As a minority person myself, I'm very sensitive to that. Mm-hmm. And so I've been working on this to be very inclusive. So I understand where you're coming from, but please read the lettering and the wording of what we're trying to do here. The initiation of this plaque was due because of the Mexican-American vets. And it's not just because of the dollar-wise, but the initiation of it. Mm-hmm. And we want to honor that initiation of them coming forward and doing this. So and then with the language, again, to be inclusive with nationalities and ethnic backgrounds, we thought that would be very inclusive with House Research and with Paul over at the Capitol grounds. So, I mean, we worked on this, and I do believe we're very inclusive.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may follow up. Representative Dominguez, I think I stated my agreement with that, and here's my response would be, if we look at the language for the, what I'm taking as language for the plaque, it could read, Minnesotan veterans of all nationalities, ethnic groups, and subgroups. And leave out everything else. Just say we honor Minnesota veterans of all nationalities, ethnic groups, and subgroups. Would that be the same thing?
Madam Chair, Representative Morrow, no, I don't think it would. Again, we are honoring those veterans, but we're also honoring the veterans of Mexican-American, of America veterans. Honoring those veterans that came forward with the initiative for this bill.
Representative
Stelzi. Thank you, Madam Chair. I share some of the same concerns. I mean, we have a limited amount of space there, and I mean, that's really what's limiting us here. I think this proposal looks, it appears to me, to identify one group of minority veterans who have served, and they happen to have, at this point in time, generated the money to put the plaque up, which is a good thing, and it's admirable. Back to Representative Junkie's point, I mean, Chinese Americans, African Americans, we only have 9 spots left, right? And they're in the next 1,000 years, there could be another war or two. And so, those are... The space limitation, I think, is a big thing.
Madam Chair, again, this is part of... This is what we struggle with. And speaking specifically to Representative Morrow's point, we would not want to go forward with our support of this if it's interpreted that whoever comes up with the money earns the plaque. We have made it a policy for the CAP board when we're working with memorials, be it with World War II Memorial, and every single one of the memorials that's been built out there has went into financial stress in fundraising. And without fail, they always come to us and say, can we sell bricks? I mean, municipalities do this, possibly some of your own municipalities do this, where they sell bricks and put names out there, and we've always made it a policy that no one buys their way into memorialization on the state property because they have the means to do so. So I would not want this in any way, shape, or form for the interpretation to be, if you can fund it, you can buy it. And so I am especially sensitive to the point Representative Morrow, With all due respect to the Mexican Americans, if that's the path we go down, I don't want to go down that path. But that's the quandary we always face, and so I'm trying to respect Mexican American vets here, and it is a quandary, and there will be, I just wanted to be very, very clear on that point. That's not the reason why we are supporting this language. We're hoping that it will stand the test of time, but if it's not going to, then I think it's the legislature's need to address this issue.
Mm-hmm.
when this project was started, my name is Michael Medina. I'm the adjutant of Mexican American Pulse 5. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I served in Vietnam in 1967-68. My father is a World War II veteran. We were really supportive of this idea when we came forth with Ripley Dominguez. And it wasn't about money. It wasn't about, Mexican Americans. It was about, it was about our group giving back. It was our group. We are proud Americans. Many of our group served this country for many, many years. We continue to serve this country. And it wasn't about money. It was just about how do we give back. Our post does a lot of things. Our post is about giving back. We give about 2 tons of food a year to the neighborhood house. We march in all the parades. When this little girl got hit by the van, in hit and run with the van in West St. Paul, our group put together a fundraiser. We came up with almost $4,000. Like I say, we're proud. We're proud to be here. I didn't have to be here. I always say I'm a child of destiny, but it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. It gave me more opportunity. I was the first one to graduate from high school in my family. I'm also the first one to graduate from college. I'm a registered architect. So that's a lot of opportunity. Now, how do we say thank you? This was lonely. So, our country is, our people serve this country well, and again, it wasn't about money. It was about getting something up there that said thank you to all our veterans. Because we serve with people of all color. When you're out there, you don't ask what color your skin is. Thank you.
Representing the family.
Well, first of all, Mr. Medina, thank you for your service and your testimony. Appreciate it. And the sacrifices that you and your family have endured as well, being in the service, we greatly appreciate it. My question is, just for argumentative sake, can we make the wall bigger? I mean, you know, as far as people coming forward, and you can see the pride and sense the pride, and rightfully so, and it's a little concerning that space is the limiting factor here, you know. I mean, if people want to be recognized and in a way that's very special to them, I don't think what's being asked is out of line by no means. And that's why I ask, why is space the limiting factor here? And who cares if somebody from a different background wants to be recognized? You know, why shouldn't they? That's my question.
Madam Chair, anything is possible. The current wall was built as part of the Veterans Service Building and the original Court of Honor, and since that time now, with the rededication of the World War II Memorial in that space, the wall is where it is. Were it to be expanded, I guess the possibilities are there. It could come off the middle of the mall. The question would be where it would stop. And as I said, once one group wants the Court of Honor, the original history behind the Court of Honor was to avoid the memorialization that we've had take place, where first the Vietnam veterans wanted a space more than just the plaque on the wall, and then the Korean veterans wanted one because they were the forgotten war and World War II, and it sort of follows what's happened in Washington, D.C. So yes, to your question, the wall could be expanded. It could not run east or west because then it would interfere with the Vietnam Memorial, and it could start on the south side also. But once you start down that road, it is a Pandora's box. I mean, it could be never ending. And again, trying to think on the spot here, if it, and I would pose this to Representative Dominguez and our guest of honor, I would call you. If it is about your way of saying thank you, the only way I could see us addressing all people of color would be, because the wording's not going to read exactly as you see here, the memorial plaque may be placed. A lot of that obviously is surplus language. But you could start, if the Mexican-Americans wanted to do the thank you, I could understand it if it was to say something like, the Mexican-American veterans would like to recognize. That way you have your name, you have the lead. That I don't know if that would be acceptable. But just trying to think off the cuff, that's the only way I can see that we try to get more towards this inclusiveness and clearly point out why their name is mentioned in the plaque itself. But
Representative Morrow?
And Madam Chair, thank you. I'm perfectly comfortable with that. That type of wording works for me. It addresses my concerns.
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess just following up on that, does that wording work for you? Representative Dominguez.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Orlo. I think I need to refer that to House Research, and we worked on that extensively. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Madam Chair. I would like to... That's how research talk a little bit about the language.
Madam Chair, Representative Dominguez, I really think that's a policy question that House Research can't answer. However, House Research has been asked in the past to research the question of whether the wall can be expanded. And Mr. Mandel noted, you can physically build a bigger wall or a different wall. But House Research also noted that there are reverse sides to each of the pillars, each of the 22 or so pillars. If the sidewalk were built around the wall, there would be a reverse side and you would immediately double the capacity. But also, and I may be wrong about that, but also... there's space between each of the pillars for approximately another three plaques of similar size. Now, maybe that wasn't conceived of, but even if one were put between each one, that would be 22 more. So that's just a technical response, and I'm sorry I can't address the policy question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps the space issue is being addressed, and if there's room, we should do these things. And if there's ways to make more room, that's, I guess, better. But I don't know that we're going to be able to address the language issue today. I think that perhaps Representative Dominguez, maybe need to consider this a little bit more and come back to us with it.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Dominguez, we can certainly move your bill along, but again, I would caution that you need to sit down maybe with your friends at the table, the CAP board, and House Research, and really, really craft that language in a way that perhaps, like was mentioned, that Mexican-American veterans would like to honor all people of color who served in the conflicts from Minnesota. There's got to be some wording... because we have no problem voting for this bill, but I won't have a problem voting for the Native American bill and the African American bill and any other bill. That's kind of the Swedish American bill. I'm half Swedish, or any other bill that comes forward, unless we're very careful with the way we do the words, because we are setting a precedent right now as we do this. So. And I know the legislature is usually consistent. Once they do that, then it's hard to shut it down. And there's lots of examples where we've tried to take a cautious approach. Road signs are one that Representative Morrow will be familiar with over in transportation. Everyone wants a road sign, so we've had to put some kind of stipulation. Who pays? Who can have one up? License plates. We've had to really ratchet back and try and figure out some really specific policies. So what we do will start setting a precedent for future plaques out there. And I would just, we'll move your bill along, but you should work before you get this to the House floor or wherever it's going with everyone involved, and be very careful to think this through, because you are setting a precedent.
Representative Dominguez.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for those words, Representative Junkie. I think you're more than Irish. I think you got a little Latino in you, too, the fighting that you're doing right now. So we will sit down again, and we'll take that as very positive with the language. We want to be very inclusive, and this is not something that we don't want to be. We want to be inclusive on everyone. And I hope, members, that, again, I want to stress this factor, that let's not make it a money factor, but an honor factor. We want to honor our veterans, and I don't want to get that money factor involved in this. So let's not mix things up here. Please don't. We will take that language and consideration, and we will work with that. So thank you.
Okay, we'll amend and, let's see, where am I? I renew the motion for House File 3240 be recommended to pass and as amended and send to the General Registry. All those in favor? Aye. Opposed? No. Pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. So, thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I mean, I look like Bob Detmer, but I am.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. This bill under consideration is House File 3298. We have a report on this bill from the Division of Veterans Affairs. I will move adoption of the subcommittee division report. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The report is adopted. And now I'll move House File 3298 be recommended to pass. We now have the bill in front of us.
Which file are we on?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm standing in for Representative Detmer. He had a personal death in the family, so he is predisposed to that, so he asked me if I would stand in for him, and I'm happy to do that. I'll just give a brief summary, and then I'll turn it over to Colonel Walnuts. But I would ask you to, as we go through this, to consider this, to go to the consent calendar. It's kind of an administrative bill. It deals with the Persian War ribbon authorization field, and typically in the National Guard, we can do medals at the state level, and we do medals and ribbons at the federal level as well. And this one has really been included into the federal awards that have been put forth, so there's really no need for the Persian Gulf War ribbon. And this just kind of cleans up the statutes. But I'll turn it over to Colonel Olmos at this point.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Olmos, Department of Military Affairs.
We came before the committee last year and we talked about a state award we wanted to add, the State Achievement Ribbon, which went about to recognize service members who did a service to state. And that's really the kind of thing that the Department of Military Affairs and actually state statute requires us, is recognize service to the state. The federal government, through their separate award system, really recognizes, as shown in the summary sheet, service to our country. And what we want to do is prevent double awards for the same type of service. So this really belongs to the federal category by statute and by our agency policy, and request that that change be made. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Not to the bill, just to the motion. Representative Severson, I think I'm going to encourage them to keep the motion to the general register, only because we are putting together an omnibus bill for Vets and Ag again. This would fit very well there, rather than having to do calendar items for all these little bills. We're going to be putting together an omnibus bill, so we'll move it out to the general register, if that'd be okay with you and Representative Detmer, and then we can include it in the omnibus bill and make sure we don't always get the calendar items. I want to make sure that these things get done, and I think it's safer to do it that way.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have no problem with that.
Any other questions or discussion? If not, I'll renew the motion that House File 3298 be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Bill passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
The bill under consideration is House File 3297. We have a report on this bill from the Division of Veterans Affairs. I move adoption of the subcommittee division report. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The report is adopted. I move the bill file 3297 be recommended to pass. We now have the bill before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And again, this is just kind of a clean up. However, this has a little more implications. The brevet rank for the National Guard, the brevet is basically an honorary motion that we do for those who have been either killed in action or have died as a result of their wounds in the line of duty. And so this promotion is administrative. It is not has no fiscal note with it, and it honors the service and that of the member. So in other words, if someone was from the Navy, was a petty officer second class, there would be an honorary rank of petty officer first class, or if it was a lieutenant, it would be a lieutenant commander. That's the Navy side. Colonel can give the National Guard side. But the bottom line is it recognizes their service and their sacrifice to our country, and the brevet rank gives them that honor symbolically. And I'll turn it over to the Colonel to take it from here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Eric Almas, Department of Military Affairs. Just want to emphasize a couple things. When this statute was originally written, we're in a time of peace, and they just didn't consider, the agency as they put it together, that, you know, if people lose their life, give their all to service their country or their state, that it's probably right thing to do is to promote them immediately so that the family can receive that honor of their ultimate sacrifice. And so, as unfortunately we find as people return from war, die in war, this is an admirable and right way to honor their service and to let their families know that we appreciate the ultimate sacrifice given. So that's why we're making this question. And then just want to emphasize, too, there's absolutely no cost to this. There's no funds or other monetary impact on any way whatsoever. It's just an honorary promotion that those people can recognize that ultimate sacrifice of that service member. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions or discussions? If not, I'll renew the motion. House File 3297 be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill passes.
Madam Chair, if I may.
I know the time is getting short here. You probably need to be out of here.
Yep.
2 minutes to go, so.
We got plenty of time.
Okay.
My committee was canceled after this, and we're getting the room.
Oh,
so.
Perfect. Okay. I'm ready then.
The bill under consideration is House File 3344. We have a report on this bill from the Division of Veterans Affairs. I move adoption of the subcommittee division report. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. I move that House File 3344 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Government Operations. We now have the bill before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have an amendment that will put the bill in the form that I'd like. We had a good discussion in the Veterans Committee, and I think this is the language that kind of came to the top as a result of that discussion. So I'd ask the committee to consider that approval of the amendment to put it in the form that we'd like to discuss. And that is the H3344A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, I'll move the H3344A1 amendment.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Adopted. Let's see.
Madam Chair, and members, this is a veterans preference bill. Some of you were in the veterans committee that we had a good discussion on, but I'll kind of lay out the situation here. Is basically in 1975. Let me even go back further. After the Civil War, Minnesota saw fit to honor its veterans and make sure that the veterans were considered above other people that were applying for state and local jobs by putting into effect what's called veterans preference. And basically that veterans preference said, if you are a veteran and you're applying for this job, you get special consideration. In fact, that special consideration consists of, if you are in a pool of other individuals, you go through a testing process. If you're a veteran, you get 5 points in that testing process, more than your contemporaries who are non-veterans. And if you're a disabled veteran, you get 10 points. At the end, the person that's at the top of the list gets hyped. 1975, we made a radical change from that policy, and we basically said, you know what, we kind of honor the service of our veterans, but we're no longer recognizing veterans' preference, and if you're at the list, we'll consider that, but we're not going to pick you. We may not pick you. And so there was, if you go back to the days of 1975, you can see that there was some tumult in our society in terms of recognizing the service of our war veterans. In fact, many of them came back and changed their uniform after they got off of the plane, or even took it off before they got on the plane to come back, because they knew the reception that they were going to receive was going to be less than favorable. And so I believe that this transition that took place in 1975 reflects some of that attitude that we as a state and pretty much as a nation had towards the service of our veterans. And we've seen some healing going on in the last few years, particularly with our war on terror, and we've seen the conduct above reproach from our military personnel. We've seen them step up to the plate, particularly in a volunteer force, of which there's no longer a draft, so these are individuals who recognize that freedom comes at a cost, and they're willing to step up to the plate to pay that cost. And so we believe that as a state, we have an obligation to those individuals as they come back to make sure that we receive them not just with open arms, but say, you know what, we are also willing to make the sacrifice to put you into a job. And it's kind of ironic that we have, in the last couple of years, we've pressed pretty heavily on our private sector to make sure that they pick up the ball, that when we have someone that's deployed, that they keep that job open for them and receive them back when they come back. And so this bill merely says to the state and local governments, you know, as state and local governments, we are going to lead the way with veterans' preference. We're saying that if there is a group of people that are applying for that job, a veteran is in that list, that he needs to be considered at the top of the list, and if there's a disabled veteran, that he needs to be considered at the very top of the list. If we go back to the 1975 era,
And Representative Hawes, who is not on this committee, was on the last committee, often speaks because of his involvement with the homeless, that there's about 25% of the homeless are veterans. Well, take that back to 1975 when these warriors were coming back from the war, some of them experiencing very traumatic experiences, what we now call today PTSD, battle fatigue, or some of the other things that were in the past, and stuffing that, going into an employment situation and then suffering some of the implications of this particular disorder, and the employers simply don't know how to cope with it. So we're basically saying, you know what, if we are a state who really honors our warriors and wants to make sure that they are integrated back in, so we don't have the same amount of homeless vets that we have today because of that, of the actions of some of this that took place. We need to be positive in our work in making sure that we take care of them. So this bill, 3344, goes to that issue. Speaking to the state hiring, in the first paragraph, section one, speaks to the state, and it says that a disabled veteran or non-disabled veteran who claims a preference under this section and who heads the list of applicants must be hired to fill that vacant position if the applicant meets the minimum qualifications. And that's important here, because if there is a veteran that's coming up with other individuals, he does not meet the minimum qualifications, he's not considered. If he meets the minimum qualifications and the vacant position is being filled, in this case, if there is more than one disabled veteran or a veteran on the top of the list and they are equally qualified, one of them must be hired. So we're saying at the state level that if there's a disabled veteran at the top of the list, we're going to hire him. Now, that may sound discriminatory, number one, but let's go back to the premise of this entire thing, that we are hiring veterans because of their prior service. They're stepping up to the plate and sacrificing, and there needs to be some consideration made. And one of the issues that's going through your mind right now is saying, well, that means that we're just going to hire vets from here on in. This is something I got, and I was trying to make a copy of before I got here, but it's from the Department of Employee Relations. And basically what this says is for veterans' preference, doing the numbers here, of all the categories and those hired, and I believe this is cumulative here, all the categories, numbers of resumes, 205,545 is 100% of those resumes. Of those that have no preference, in other words, those are those that step up to the plate who have no veteran status at all, 179,136, or about 87% of those applicants that are applying for these jobs, have no veteran status. Those that have a 5-point veteran's preference, 7.8%, and those who have a 10-point, 1.21%. So we're talking about a very minute number of individuals who are stepping up to the plate who have this edge or this disability that gives them consideration. And I guess it's for that reason and the other reason stated that I think this is the right thing to do. It's not going to take a whole bunch of people out of the picture, but it is going to say to our disabled veterans that we consider your service and your sacrifice in the hiring through the state position as a definite factor. Second part of the bill in Section 2, the ranking of veterans in the local government, basically it says if an eligible with a rating augmented by the veteran's preference is in the top half of the qualifying persons on the eligible list for a vacant position and the vacant position is being filled, that person must be hired. If two or more eligibles with rating augmented by the veteran's preference are equally rated at the top of the list, one of them must be hired. And the things that we've experienced in the past on the local side is that if there is a veteran with a veteran's preference who has stepped up to the plate for the job and is looking for the interview and is looking for being hired, sometimes what happens is the list is put forward and the veteran may be at the top of the list, and then they basically say, you know what, we don't want to look at this list, we're going to hire from another list. And they get around that. So what this does is it kind of squeezes it down and says, look, even at the local government level, we think that you need to recognize that the veterans have come back to serve their country, and the veterans' preference is being enforced. So I would look forward to a discussion on this particular provision, and if we can make it better, I'm all game for making it better, but I think this is something that we as a state need to really step up to the plate and say, hey, we honor the service of our veterans, and we're going to show that by making sure they get hired. And I would take any questions, Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Severson, I'd like to thank you also for your service, and the Colonel goes to you as well. Thank you for your service to our country. As far as the veteran, that individual, they need to be eligible in all other aspects or trained and qualify for that position, correct? In all of the terms, all their bases.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, thank you. Yeah, thanks for that question. That is correct. There is a minimum qual that is put out for these positions, minimum qualifications, and they have to meet above that line. Now, if there's a test, and the test set is a 100-point test, and 70 is the cutoff, and they hit 69, they aren't considered in the list. They are not minimally qualified. Okay, so they do not jump into this list, and there is no 5-10 points that's going to take them into that list. If they have to meet the minimum qualifications, once they meet that, then those points are added on, and then they're considered on the list. And another issue I might address as well that has been brought to my attention is that any of these employees that are hired at the state and local level are on a six-month probation minimum. So basically, if they are not performing, if they are picked, they're not performing, there's nothing that precludes the employer from saying, you know what, we're going back to the list and we're going to choose again.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Severson, for bringing this forward. I think that your comments about what happened in 1975 are probably very accurate, and I think that's very unfortunate that that happened, and I'm glad that we're finally doing something about it. I do have a couple questions that I'm a little bit confused about. The list of qualified people, is that the list that is only 10 long? Because otherwise, if they're in the top half of the qualified people, if there's 50 qualified people, does that mean if they're number 24, they automatically get the job? Or does that list automatically go to 10 that are then given and they have to be in the top 5 of that 10? So I'm just a little bit confused about that. If you could just go over that one more time, I'd appreciate it.
Representative
Stevenson. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Faust, thanks for that question. It varies from different, in the local level, they may have a pool of 3, they may have a pool of 5, they may have a pool of 25. If they're at 12 on a pool of 25, then they would be hired. This would basically say that they would be hired. And this is some of the language that came out of the last committee discussion, because we kind of said, well, you know, how do you implement this? Is it if they're at the top 2, you have to hire them, or if they're at the top 5, you have to hire them? But the pools may vary depending on the job and the number of applicants. And so that is where we're saying that if they're in the top half, whether it's 3, 5, 7, 10, whatever it is, they have to be in that top 50%. Now, if they're 6 of 10, then they would not necessarily need to be hired. So we're kind of cutting it off here, saying if there are 5 others that are better qualified via the resume and the list of the ranking, then they do not need to be hired here. But if they are 4th out of 10, then yeah. Or if they're 5th out of 10, then they should be hired.
I do have a follow-up. I just want to make sure this includes all veterans, National Guard included, I'm assuming. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Faust, and that's a really good question. The veteran status is for those who have fulfilled the requirements under Title 10, or under our statutes that basically say they have served 180 days of continuous days of active duty. I believe that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Junkie?
That answered my question. I was wondering if it was 180 days or more, and you just answered that in the affirmative. So it's not for the weekend guard members. It's for those that were actually deployed in a theater for 180 days or more, or put on active duty with the Army.
Right.
Are there any other questions, discussions? If not.
And Madam Chair, I believe this needs to go to government operations.
hearing none, I renew the motion that House File 3344 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to Government Operations Committee. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Bill passed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Hearing no further business, the meeting is adjourned.